Hey everybody, and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. This is Hayes Carl, the eighth sexiest man in Americana, Texas folk music. And this is probably the most exciting part of the show you're about to listen to. Fair warning. And now I'd like to introduce host Reeve Hamilton and the Tribcast crew. K-Mag Yo-Yo.
Thank you, Hayes. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast. Joining me is editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
We're not supposed to say it's the third week of October, whatever
it is. Is it the third week of October? It all sort of runs together for me.
It's the damn presidential campaign. It's turned our brain into mush.
It's the second week in October.
It's the second week in October, fine.
It's definitely in October, though. I mean, that's...
As far as we know, baseball's in the playoffs, so it must be October.
It must be. That's managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Go Cards.
The Nelson Cruz of our podcast.
And Jim Henson.
He doesn't get it.
UT's completely mixed Texas it, Politics it? Project.
I'm happy to be here and unsnarky.
Henson doesn't like baseball. Henson just likes basketball.
That ain't right.
It isn't right.
Well, especially right now.
Your guys are on strike. You might as well watch baseball.
Are you a big NBA person?
He's a big Lakers
big-ish,
fan.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
He's a big-ish Lakers fan.
Well, we only just met.
This is a great podcast. What's it about?
Yeah. Well, good question, Ross.
It's about to get worse.
Well, it's very much like a kitchen table where we just talk about whatever's on our mind.
Because it really wasn't enough that there was four white guys here. We had to start by talking about sports.
Well, I'm basically doing my best Charlie Rose impression and just letting this get entirely off the rails.
You're not gassy enough. I know. Come on.
So last night, Charlie Rose moderated the Perry's fourth nationally televised presidential debate.
Right. Seventh presidential debate, fourth with Perry, right?
And, you know, we'll talk about how that went or didn't go. And
it'd be a short conversation.
It went fine. He didn't do anything stupid.
But you know what? This is not a case where flat is the new up, Ross. This is a case the narrative had to change.
This is a case
the
where flat
did not change.
This is a case where flat didn't matter.
Well, it didn't matter in the sense that going into the debate, people were discounting his chances. Coming out of the debate, they're discounting his chances.
I think we're going to forget this moment. I don't think we've got a marker here.
I'm still not discounting his chances, as you know.
Right, right.
But
I still don't think he's going to win, I'll just say.
I do.
Do you think it helps him that it was on Bloomberg TV?
What was that channel?
Where is that?
And that old Muppet from the theater box was the host of that program, the guy in the bow tie. What's his name? Waldorf?
Statler.
Yeah. And he was on Channel 999.
You knew that it was not on one of the premium cable channels because the people who were the hosts, it was like Matthew Dowd kept looking at those people going, how the hell did I get here? They were awful.
And his Matthew Dowd had a bizarre mid-debate sort of halftime show moment.
Yeah.
That was... Nothing you would see.
But no wardrobe malfunction, fortunately. Right. His halftime show.
Well, I would say better if he'd worn the mascot's head or something, right?
You know, all these things that we can wander off into, I think, suggest.
You want to get back to substance?
Suggest that. I mean, I
right.
agree.
Professor Focus, class is now in session.
Yeah. I agree a little with. I agree somewhat with Ross that I think, and you know, this is one version of this that we always have in the podcast that we're talking about this thing that just happened as the decisive inflection point, and I've lost track of all the decisive inflection points that we've had.
I don't think it's decisive. I think it would have been decisive had he turned it around.
The whole narrative was that it was his make or break debate.
Do or die.
It was on his, you know, preferred topic of choice, the economy. It was his time to like really shine, and he definitely did not shine.
Not only his topic of choice, the only topic that is the basis for his candidacy. No economy, no Perry candidacy. There's nothing else for him really to run on. That was the whole basis for his campaign was the economy.
This is all a media construct. I mean, we're watching stock prices very well. I'm just saying that we set up this whole fake. You know, this is the moment when, this is the most important, this is the biggest big and the littlest little. It's just crazy. I mean, we're just watching stock prices here. He's got $17 million. He's in the game until January. The guys that are in trouble here are the guys who don't have $17 million and don't have any traction. You know, this is going to weed out. We're going to get out to three or four guys. Perry's going to be sitting there. He's got time to learn. He's raising money. You know, it's not perfect, but it's working.
I still think he's a nominee. I mean, let me be clear. I'm not disagreeing with you that this is not the nail in his coffin. I'm just saying that from the perspective of what the narrative was going into the debate, he needed to do something he did not do.
Right. I mean, for now, if it's a story of missed opportunities, I mean, I think you point to what actually the big missed opportunity is that and that is to really winnow out this field, because part of the problem he's having is, you know, and I think we could, it would be worthwhile to actually break down what everybody means by, oh, I'm not very good at debates. I mean, there's a certain why question there that
Perry came out afterwards and said that, hey, debates are not my strong
suit. Well, they've been saying it all along in terms of
As rarely as you've done them.
Yeah, right. You know, in terms of setting expectations. But I think, you know, every time you go out there with eight guys
and Michelle Bachmann,
thank you, and you don't figure out a way to knock some of those people out, and that's one of the interesting story here, is that the rotation of, you know, Herman Cain and Rick Perry and you know, all the other people, just means that Gingrich and Santorum and to some degree Bachmann and Huntsman just keep hanging around, and that means every one of these times that you get everybody together and that people try to assess the field, it's just crowded. So on one hand, we all notice Rick Perry's, you know, earning what would be a, you know, special edition of the Furniture Award from Texas Monthly last night. On the other hand, you know, you notice that because you expect him to do more. And, you know, there's just a bunch of people that nobody gets a lot of time unless you really get up there and punch for it, which he's clearly not good at doing.
But there'd be an argument intellectually if you could do this. You couldn't. Nobody would allow this to happen. It would be to criticize if you did it. But you should just say, basically, come on. Herman Cain's not going to be president. Come on. Ron Paul's not going to be president. And I just with that, I just got off Deborah Medina's Christmas card list.
Right.
Come on. Rick Santorum is not going to be president. This is a Perry and Romney race. It was, it is. Okay? I'd like to see the two of them go toe-to-toe, just the two of them. None of this fake, everybody all in, right? Because otherwise, you're never going to have the opportunity for that real contrast to be drawn. Now, maybe it's about him staying around long enough that one little Indian, two little Indians, they all fall, and he's the last not Mitt standing. And maybe at that point you get that.
Well, that's clearly,
but I'd sure like to have that name.
Yeah, but that's part of the issue. I mean, one of the things in that setting last night, in the setting with so many people around, you know, one of Charlie Rose's tables, is that one of the big advantages Perry has right now, this $15 million in the bank, is useless to him at that moment. He could have $40 million in the bank, and when you're sitting at the table and they're taking turns. Now, one thing I would say, I think, Evan, is that you can't, it's a little early to be taught, you know, to be saying that. And Perry has not been in very long. So as the coverage continues to accumulate, at, you know, what seems fair right now to boil it down to a two-person race, if something happens and then one of those people is no longer around, it could be Perry, it could be Romney.
Do you dispute that it's a two-person race?
I think it's a three-person race.
I think there's nothing in the polling right now that justifies excluding Herman Cain.
I don't think you can exclude
That Herman Cain is not going to be president.
But I don't think you can exclude Herman Cain, and I don't think you can exclude Ron Paul.
Cain doesn't even want to be president.
I actually think there's a two-space race right now. Basically, there's the Romney space,
and
there's the not Romney space. And and Rick Perry has clearly not defined himself as the clear owner of the non Romney space. I mean, I think he was for a while, but because of, frankly, his poor performance, he's ceded that ground.
Every time Hayes Carl is on the show, we have the Not Romneys comes up, which I think is a great band name.
It would be a good. It is a good band name, actually. I agree.
They play exciting music.
I thought that the as an emblem of the ridiculous, you know, non-reality that we're in right now with regard to this field. Look at all the focus on Herman Cain's 999 plan.
It's easy to understand. I mean, it's got all the advantages and disadvantages of a simple thing.
It's just not easy to implement or easy to see how it actually does anything.
Well, the problem...
It's a gimmick.
The problem with that analysis, Evan...
It's like someone said, nine pizzas for $9 in 9 minutes.
The guy,
he's
the only candidate with a bumper sticker right now. And so he's the quickest, easiest one to understand and explain. And it works as a messaging thing for now, just because... You say Herman Cain, people say, oh, yeah, I know what he's about. You say Rick Perry and say, okay, so now tell me about him. I mean, he's got this clearly defined – that's the guy with the plan. He's got that 999 thing.
And it's working for him. And he did well last night. I mean, he was very, you know, telegenic last night. He spoke enthusiastically. But it isn't in this sort of like – he's doing very well, but in sort of a laughable way in some ways. Like, you know, his retorts are – the problem with that analysis is – that's incorrect.
He's very
and stuff like that.
Where it's sort of, was actually one of the best things of the night.
Yeah, he's so new at this that he doesn't know what to be afraid of.
He's running for Secretary of Commerce. He's not running for president.
That's probably right. But he's
what do you think about his
or party chair? The good Michael Steele.
What do you think about his bringing up Alan Greenspan as his model for the Fed?
Well, as I tweeted, he's not going to get on the Andrea Mitchell show now.
Well, they sort of panned the camera around, and all the other candidates broke into these Jimmy Carter grins. They were all like, "Oh yes, this is great," Say Paul Volcker. Ron Paul looked like he was going to jump out of his chair.
Herman Cain had a tactical advantage last night, right? I mean, because Romney's not taking him seriously, people were going to, they were going to encourage the space. The moderators, gave him a lot of structural position. He sat there right between the guys. So,
because he got Perry's seat.
Because he got Perry's support. That was based on polling.
There's an advantage to him being in this race in the place he is for Romney, because if Cain is up, then that means Perry is not up as much. And so Romney was like, "Oh, Herman, can I get you a pillow?
So you're Romney, you're sitting there, and
an hors d'oeuvre?
Romney apparently agrees with Evan. Cain is not going to be the president, so let me elevate him past the other guys, right? I'll let this not the president. We got a not Romney who's not the president. We'll let him take all of the oxygen from Perry and from Paul and from anybody else who wants to pipe up.
Well, and I'm going to do something I haven't done, which is say, we should give Romney some credit. I mean, they played that tactically very well last night.
This has been a very well-run. The Romney campaign has really, relatively speaking, been a very well-run.
Well, I think the way that he divided his attention between the other candidates, the way that, he was able to take the question about health care, it was a very good retort. That basically swung back at Perry, and then also
that was
a
very good retort. Actually,
I think most intelligently using his question on Bachman was super smart.
They had a moment to question each other, and he chose to lob a softball to Michelle Bachman and basically ask her how would she make the country great or something.
Right. So with Rick Perry sitting there once again looking like furniture, and Bachman getting a little more airtime and giving her a little oxygen in Iowa, which only helps Romney.
Tactically, could it be better for Perry to just, there were other candidates on the stage that fought their way into questions that they weren't asked. Like Newt Gingrich interrupted everyone's question just to rattle on about something for a while. Perry chose to not do that at all and just sat back, and then the moderators didn't go to him a lot. Is it better for him to just sort of, like Ross says, this doesn't matter, let's just let this pass without any errors? Should he have tried to elbow his way on?
He didn't make an impression, positive or negative. He didn't make an impression last night. It's just, he was there. Huntsman was there.
Right, but we're past the point of him being able to take a knee in these debates. I think in the first couple of debates, had he said less, then it would have been better for him. This was a debate in which he had something he had to demonstrate in an affirmative sense.
And see, I don't agree with that either, because I think they've got the money. They're getting ready to do the ad campaign. I think you're right, Evan, in that he eventually has to have a good debate.
Right.
But he really only needs one.
Well, Scott Braddock had a really great observation. He said, I think Perry is going to get more attention from the parade cover this Sunday. More people are going to see that parade cover than ever even thought about this debate or knew they had Bloomberg on their cable TV. I think that's probably right.
And that's a classic Perry campaign move. Yeah, we'll go on Bloomberg TV and kind of sit there and play passive, and then we'll be on the cover of Parade local paper.
Bloomberg TV is like the national equivalent of having a gubernatorial debate during high school football in Texas. It's like, what happened?
1998.
Right. I mean,
They did that with Bush and
Morrow.
Here's why I think you guys may not be right on the significance of this.
You can say wrong.
I acknowledge that this is all
come right at us.
People view these things differently. You have said very often, Ross, that what Perry is really running in right now is the money primary.
Right.
Part of the he raised $17 million. I continue to want to see an Excel spreadsheet that shows me how much of that $17 million was raised in the first half of the 49 days, and how much was raised in the second half. I know that Mark Miner put out a statement saying we raised more money per day on average after the first debate,
right,
than we did before. That's the top line. I want to see the details. I want to know how much money they raise since the campaign started going off the rails a little bit. And part of what drives the money primary is the degree to which the chatter out in the world, not placing any more importance on us than there actually should be, but the degree to which the chatter out in the world builds confidence in the narrative that allows donors to come to the Perry Party. I would argue that these debates have succeeded in draining confidence largely from the narrative, and that last night did not help in that effort. On the heels of Christie coming in, I thought that Christie's performance yesterday with Romney was Oscar worthy.
Christie was a better Christie was a better piece for Romney than the debate was.
I thought Christie's press conference getting out of the race was ridiculous, but I thought that Christie yesterday, in his brevity and in specifically what he said about Romney and the shots he took without mentioning Perry's name at Perry, I thought was a much more significant occurrence.
Right.
And I'm telling you, that plus Perry kind of phoning it in last night at the debate, it did not significantly change the confidence narrative that will ultimately be a contributor to the finance primary. That's the argument I'm making.
I think you're right about the part of the money primary that involves little donors. But I think the big donors are listening to a different conversation, and they're talking to the people in the campaign who are saying, look, he's not going to do well in these debates. They've probably, you know, likely been saying, unless they're on drugs, they've likely been saying all along, he's not going to do well in debates. That's not his deal. What you need to watch is the other metrics. You need to watch how he's doing with crowds. The polling is troublesome, but I don't think the debate is driving the polling necessarily. And you need to.
And the polling is not conclusive because, as has now become like a stock thing to do, if you go back 4 years,
It's crazy pants polling.
You know,
it's
President like Giuliani, and President Clinton were going to be in the general election. I mean, we know what the polls
were.
Right, years.
McCain was in. Jim flipped this thing around this morning from 538. It was McCain was in third or fourth place.
Well, to be fair, it was in Real Clear Politics. But
oh, sorry,
okay. I love 538 right. too, though. Yeah, McCain was way down. I mean, the narrative, we keep using the term narrative, which we had to purge soon. But, the story at this time 4 years ago was, McCain has underperformed. He's out of money. He seems old and a little crazy. And
straight
he's
talk expresses
carrying his own bags.
And he's
right?
carrying his own bags, right? So now, the cycles are different. It's always hard to tease what's new and what's not, what's predictable and what's not. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I think you've sort of had this moment when you sort of, we went through the part of the campaign where we were looking at new candidates. This one. I think probably the Christie Palin decisions not to run are the end of that part of the primary.
I think that, now we go that, to was, the, that was the reset.
Now we go to the next part of the primary, which is which of the not Romneys are off stage? Throw these four off. I mean, there's four at the bottom, obviously, that you just take and say, you guys were out.
You didn't think that John Huntsman's comedy routine really put him over the edge last night?
I got to tell you
one
thing.
It did put him over the edge last night, actually.
That guy has got the worst advice about what he says.
Well, there's also one thing about this group of candidates, other than, and this may, and I think, this is, I say this half facetiously, but I think this may be helping Kane, is that they're a remarkably unfunny group of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Time somebody tries
Gingrich
to tell a joke, they're terrible.
Gingrich and Santorum are both just angry. Huntsman has the worst comic timing ever. I mean, right. he's terrible.
He's like the reverse Billy Crystal.
And honestly, the reason that Romney passing the question off to Bachman was so brilliant was there was absolutely no chance of Bachman saying something that somebody did not roll their eyes at.
Right.
Right? I mean, honestly.
The
devil's couldn't even
in
get
the
number
details?
Of kids
Give
yet. Right.
Holy cow.
I've got 28 kids. I've got 5 biological and 22 foster. Apparently, none of those kids grew up to be a math teacher. Right?
I also like the sub-theme of the Greek meme last night. So Rick Santorum, pleases the Twitter crowd by talking about Greek something or other. And then Perry goes to a frat house afterwards.
Well, and at the frat, we should talk about the frat house.
Actually. It's like Animal House. Also, with Dartmouth, right? So I was thinking, is Perry Niedermeyer or Marmalard? Which one is he? Actually?
But the big headline, of course, from the frat house was that
he studied history with Blutarsky. Yeah.
And he mentioned we didn't fight the Revolutionary War in the 16th century,
right?
Et cetera. I don't know if that really. I think you've given
cares?
A pass for that.
You know what? Yeah. Out here in one of Obama's 57 states, we don't really care about that stuff. I mean, those kinds of gaffes don't make a difference.
Well, he was locating the American Revolution. In the deepest roots of the Enlightenment.
Anybody in the press who starts going after that stuff, we just look like a bunch of Ivy League snobs. I mean, it's just ridiculous to pick on that. Pick on the other stuff.
I just think the only thing from yesterday that's going to last is Chris Christie.
I think the Christie thing was very significant.
We should just mention explicitly that he endorsed Romney.
Nobody's going to remember
it was
this debate.
Executed
except,
so well,
except
I thought,
that the
too.
Guy who jumped the Saturday Night Live shark, who jumped into the Saturday Night Live window was Charlie Rose.
Oh God!
I mean, if you're a writer at Saturday Night Live, you didn't see anything here from the candidates, but I can use that Rose thing. That's good.
You know what was funny? And this was pointed out immediately on Twitter yesterday that the Saturday Night Live skit of Christie and Romney from the other day was almost exactly replicated in the way they staged that thing yesterday. I mean, if you ran them side by side, it looked exactly the same.
Right. So this isn't really an election; it's just a show.
Before we move away from this, I actually have a question. I'm curious what you guys think. You guys are all following this stuff. I mean, aside from all the horse race in, out, tactical stuff, what do we think about the kind of policy tone of these debates, or is anyone even noticing?
Well, I thought Perry's weirdest comment last night was when he said that we don't need to be worried about this policy or that policy, which, you know, he was sort of, also he was only focused on energy from his own perspective. So I don't know if there is a policy tone, really. I mean, it's just sort of like throw something at the wall or don't, and then just attack each other.
With the exception of Herman Cain, most of the policy stuff has been, I'm going to do whatever Obama hasn't done, or I'm going to go in the opposite direction. It's all been defined as kind of a negative space in some ways. It's like, you know, our economic policy is going to be the opposite of that, and our immigration policy is going to be the opposite of that. And our, you know, I mean, that's sort of how, I mean, Perry's going to lay out, it's two policies this week. It's the environmental or the energy policy and a jobs plan. He's supposed to lay these things out this week. And maybe we'll see this start to flesh out. But the only guy who's got a policy thing that he's actually running on, it seems to be Cain.
Well, but I want to go back to Reese's point about the energy thing. So Perry, you're right. I mean, every answer that Perry gave, somehow you could breadcrumb it back to the energy thing. Obviously, they said, look, the energy thing will test well. We think this sounds good. You're from Texas. You know a little bit about this.
Do you think he was overcoached, overcorrected?
Well, here's the problem. And this is, again, I can't understand the preparation that he goes through for these debates. The energy, I mean, the economy, pardon me again, is his issue. If the economy were good, everything Perry did in Texas would not add up to a presidential candidacy. The whole basis for his candidacy is the economy, because all the other stuff adds up to a guy who was a more conservative politician than probably the rest of the country. That's why they want him just to be talking about the economy. So you get him on the economy in an economic debate. You don't talk about, where's his Sharpie last night? Where was he talking about, oh, we have to get rid of regulation on business? Where was he talking about
tort reform? He didn't even do his 4 points.
He mentioned tort reform because Greg Abbott actually tweeted. I didn't think of this until I saw it on Twitter. Greg Abbott tweeted, well, Perry's the only one who talked about tort reform. And that's probably right. He mentioned it. Yeah. But Perry has an argument to make. You can disagree with it. You can take issue with it. You can pick at it. But he has a fairly substantive argument to make about the economy. Now, again, people will pick at it, but he can make it. But he didn't make it.
That's what I'm saying.
He didn't make it.
Articulate it, yeah.
How could he go into a debate about the economy and not make his argument? I'm baffled by the preparation.
Well, this is pretty speculative at this point, but I mean, I agree with the piece of that. I mean, it sure looked from the outside like, you know, he gets the question, because the energy thing most stuck out, and where he eventually mentioned tort reformers on the healthcare question. And so it's almost as if you could see him saying, okay, the plan is to tease the Friday economic speech based on energy, mention energy to tease the speech, and then get to where you're going. But it's just he's just not very good at that. And I thought the end of that answer was actually kind of close to what you're asking for, Evan. He spun out a reasonably coherent argument about what they've done in healthcare. Again, whether you buy it or not, that it included tort reform, it included some of the insurance legislation, and it had the components that made a certain amount of sense. But by the time he got to that, you're not going, oh, he's talking about X, Y, and Z. You're still going, why is he talking about energy and healthcare?
But it wasn't out the windshield. It was out the rearview mirror. It was, here's what we did in Texas. It's not, right, here's what I'm going to do. And the only guy who's done sort of a, here's what I'm going to do, or who's articulated it well, is Mr. 999.
Yeah, and Romney has put that 59-point plan together. But I thought what 59, I think, but what Romney said, what Cain said to Romney last night, that was pretty interesting, was, can you explain?
Right. Do you know all 59 points? Right.
No, but I thought Romney had a good point. He said, listen, you know, sometimes a very simplistic answer just isn't adequate.
Yeah, I actually thought that was pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, and it's...
I mean, it made him look like he was teaching Cain, like, here's how you do this.
And thing. It is the problem with Cain's plan, which is it's too simplistic.
Right, and it brought that out in a very lean way.
Right. Just in case Perry has to return to the state, or if his presidential candidacy fades away, you know, what are the issues that he will have to deal with or that are going on in his absence? One that stands out is... the fact that on the heels of our legislative session, now we have multiple lawsuits coming because of school finance.
Right.
How big a deal is that, Ross?
Well, the schools are suing this time on adequacy, and they're coming in on saying, you know, you're just not putting enough into the schools to make them work right. And this plays into an economic argument that, you know, I'm sure the Romneys and people like that are going to pick up, you know, after the election. I mean, after we get through the presidential thing, you know, it obviously puts the legislature, assuming the schools win this suit or that they are threatening to win this suit, puts the legislature in a place where they're saying, well, we're going to have to spend some money to settle this case. They're already starting with a big deficit. They've got a fairly large amount of rainy day money that's going to be there, but they've also got $5 or $6 billion in Medicaid funding that they set aside that's going to immediately eat into the rainy day fund. So they've got another fiscal mess on their hands. So Perry's got a short-term problem. This is going to play into the election, and he's got a long-term problem. If he loses, he's got to come back and deal with it.
And the price of oil is declining.
Right.
You know, so I mean, the interesting thing from a, I don't know, call it whatever you want, a kind of, I guess, dork perspective, though, is the fact that...
I can't imagine where this is going.
It's essentially, though, that the lawsuit...
Say some more.
That the lawsuits, I know, that gets everybody out there in podcast line, people are going, no, this is going to be really good.
Yeah, no
you,
pressure.
You think the people in podcast land are averse to the dork perspective?
Right. Yeah, there is that. I mean, my people.
Yes, you are the Fonzie of the dork perspective.
But the point being that the way that the lawsuits have become basically a regular institutional feature of the way we do school finance in Texas.
This is not a surprise.
I think have become is you know, yeah. I think they already are.
Right.
You know, we solved school finance in 1949 with the Gilmer Aiken bill,
right.
And we've
been
in court ever since.
But the broader point from the Dork perspective is that, you know, when you look at the broader landscape and the political culture in the state, you know, this really, I mean, this tells you something, right? This tells you that we're willing, you know, to continue to put Band-Aids on it because nobody will stare the issue right in the face, and the culture won't permit a different range of solutions. Now, you know, out there in Dorkland, there, you know, if I was to tweet that, I would immediately get five people saying, so you just want to throw more money at the problem, huh?
That'd be good. That would up your clout score.
Right.
Which could use a pump, yes. Anyway, I mean, I think that, but that, you know, there's an interesting piece of that which just says, you know, nobody is surprised that they're filing lawsuits. Right?
Well, yeah.
It's just part of the cycle.
And legislators will tell you, I mean, Jim Keffer was quoted in the paper saying, yesterday, and legislators will tell you that the politics of this are very difficult, and unless the court twists your arm behind your back, you don't have the political clout or will to say, well, we're going to have to spend more money or we're going to have to do this thing, because it makes everybody so crazy when you do it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
They are responsive.
I would direct your attention to an interview that we posted today with John Folks, who is the superintendent of Northside Independent School District of San Antonio. Morgan
right.
Smith did it. He is just voted by various education groups as superintendent of the year, and he makes this very point. He says, look, everybody wants cover. They want to be, well, we don't want to have to, but the courts made us.
Right.
He said, no, we ought to do it because it's the right thing for the kids of Texas. We shouldn't have to wait for the courts to come and you know, with a red-hot poker chase after us. We should do it because it's right.
You say lack of clout and will, I mean, I think it's more will than clout.
John Folks was actually very good. He was one of the best panelists I saw at the Tribune Festival a couple weeks ago.
He's a very, very smart guy. And, you know, the fact is there are very smart people in the education world who just view that funding question different from the people who would attack Jim on Twitter.
Right.
And, you know, I'd be willing to hear that conversation take place, but the problem is we haven't even gotten to the point where people want to have that conversation.
Well, you'll have the conversation in the light of the court decision.
We're going to have to.
This is how we reformed the prison system. We had lawsuits. This is how we reformed mental health.
Yeah.
Mental hospitals, mental schools, you know, all of those things. We had lawsuits.
What do all those things have in common?
A cowardly legislature waiting for a court to tell them what to do.
They're in Texas.
Yeah, and a lack of commitment to using, you know, to providing state services and to funding state services.
Right. I want to come back to what Reeve asked, which is, what does Perry find when he returns, whether he's the president-to-be, nominee and then president-to-be, or whether he's just coming back to serve out the remainder of his term?
I hear they're almost done with the mansion.
I think that's probably right. Look, well, the commute from the mansion to the Capitol is shorter than the commute from Westlake. That's definitely right. Look, I think it's the public education lawsuits is one thing.
Right.
Anybody who thinks that the higher ed reform fight is over, that the August 25th UT Regents meeting was the kumbaya moment that made everybody happy and hold hands, you're blind.
Right.
There's a huge amount of higher ed reform stuff that is still being fought about, if not visible, then invisible to the naked eye, but it's there.
If Perry's presidential campaign ends at some point, that his interest in that issue probably has not gone away permanently.
Hell no. And you know, people in the university world are joking about which regental appointments Governor Elteif would make. That actually assumes a lot.
Right.
The reality is that we still have a higher ed reform situation that's brewing. And then on health care, we know that at a minimum, we've kicked the costs of the health care problem we have in the state down to the next session. And that the margins tax is not going to get any prettier, as much lipstick as you put on that particular financial pig. We're going to go into the next session with a shortfall, and all these issues are going to come right back up again. And so in some ways, if you're Rick Perry and you come back, you think, oh, crap.
Well, right. Even closer on the horizon, just because it was teased in the U.S. House of Representatives yesterday, Sheila Jackson Lee got up and did a speech asking Perry to condemn the possible establishment of Confederate flag license plates by the DMV in December. Do you think that will be an issue on his presidential campaign or in the state when the board has to make that decision?
I don't think so in a Republican primary. If it was a general, yeah. But, I mean, in a Republican primary, who's going to jump into that? I mean, all the southern states are right in front of them. It's December or January. Florida's up. South Carolina's up. I think I'm just
Obama would be happy to run against Bull Connor, but I'm not certain that the problem in the primary is a big one.
Yeah, right. I think it's one of those issues that classically, I mean, the Perry campaign makes hay out of, where Confederate license plates come up, you know, quote-unquote MSM / you know, liberal socialist media.
May as well just call them MSNBC.
Goes crazy, and then we go to our base and say, you know, we're your guy, and these people are all crazy.
Did you see Jerry Patterson's quote? And Jerry Patterson, who sponsored the move to make these license plates, responding to Sheila Jackson Lee's passionate speech about how they should not be allowed, I think the quote was just something like, I don't really want to engage with Sheila Jackson Lee, although she's kind of funny.
Yeah. This is why I always think Jerry Patterson gets such great, you know, the candor of Jerry Patterson. His response basically is, yeah, I like the Confederate license plates. What of it?
Yeah.
Is so much different from the average person who wants to, like, you know, finesse the response. He's like,
everybody
so
settle
what?
Down. He doesn't do everybody
doesn't
settle down.
Care.
He just does, you know, yeah, that's what I think.
That's a crack up.
I think we need to sponsor some kind of a cage match. I'd like to see Sheila Jackson Lee, Jerry Patterson.
I don't know this. I would love to know how
she
all of this.
She may be packing heat in that hairdo of hers, actually. It might be a fair fight.
What's the... I'm just going to walk past that. Keep on walking. What does all this Confederate flag stuff look like to a Northern Republican? I just wonder how that.
Ray Sullivan refers to them to a Northeast Republican.
Well, just to a Northern Republican, just to a non-Southerner
say
in the Republican
Yankees.
Primary.
Well, you're talking about Yankees.
I'm not talking just about Yankees. I'm also talking about Midwesterners. So I'm talking about people who are not from the South looking at this Confederate flag thing and saying, why are we still talking about this? I don't think
it looks good to them. That's my analysis.
Is that your final answer, Reeve? You think so? Really?
Yeah.
You know, is there a Confederate flag on your Vanderbilt diploma?
That was a moment when the podcast
dead silence.
Really
she turned
kind of
red when you said that.
On that note, because we let Hayes Carl do Mary Madeline's outro last week, we're going to let her do his outro. Evan's shaking his head.
Just that phrase taken out of context would be troubling.
Well, let's turn it over to her.
If you have any questions or comments about the Tribcast, you can email podcasts at texastribune.org.
All right. On behalf of Evan Ross, Jim, our producer Todd, this has been the Tribcast.
Can we play The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down now?
Oh, that would be great. Can we do that?
Todd says we have
right.
Fair use issues.
Thanks for listening.
Ka-chunk.